Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalized approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover, and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam.
I'm Dr. Kate Steele.
And I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And today's episode is You Got a Nerve, Part 1, where we'll discuss post-delivery nerve injury in obstetric patients. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANZCA.
When Kate and I were planning episodes for this season, the topic of post-delivery nerve injury popped up, and it's a topic that we both agree warrants a revision.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not too often that we're asked to review a patient with post-delivery neurology, and it's actually difficult to remember the relevant anatomy and clinical signs necessary for a thorough assessment when you're not using that knowledge regularly.
That's right. If you don't use it, you lose it. So let's jump right in and revise this topic. First and foremost, peripartum nerve injury in obstetric patients can either occur as an intrinsic obstetric palsy, where nerve damage occurs intrinsic to the mechanics of labour or fetal pressure on the nerves in the obstetric setting, or it can be as a result of neuraxial blockade. Postpartum sensory or motor dysfunction has an incidence that approaches 1%, and the vast majority of cases that occur are intrinsic obstetric palsies. Nerve injury as a result of neuraxial anaesthesia represents a very small percentage of these cases. Numbers vary from study to study.
A prospective French study of more than 70,000 blocks showed an injury occurrence rate of 5.9 per 10,000 for spinal anaesthesia and 2 per 10,000 for epidural anaesthesia. Other prospective studies quote similar incidences of approximately 1 per 10,000 blocks. Interestingly, the UK's NAP3 described an incidence of permanent nerve damage as a result of neuraxial anaesthesia of between 0.2 and 1.2 per 100,000 blocks, and this was based on 320,000 neuraxial anaesthetics. Ultimately, even though we know the incidence of nerve injury as a result of anaesthetic intervention in obstetric patients is significantly less common, we're often asked to review every patient complaining of neurological symptoms in whom a neuraxial technique has been used. So it's vital that we're able to sort out what's actually going on.
There are three different types of nerve injury as described by Seddon, and these can be further subclassified with Sunderland's grading system according to the severity of the nerve injury. First, we have a neuropraxia, which represents the mildest and most superficial form of traumatic nerve injury. It is characterized by damage to myelin with possible focal segmental demyelination at the site of injury, but without disruption of the axon continuity and its surrounding connective tissues. This type of injury results in a transient disruption to nerve function, which often recovers spontaneously within weeks to a few months. Neuropraxia comprises a grade 1 injury.
Second, we have axonotmesis, which represents a more serious type of traumatic injury in which there is disruption of the axon. The extent of the disruption can vary and can be graded as follows. A grade 2 injury, in which there is a damaged axon but with an intact endoneurial tube. A grade 3 injury, in which the perineurium remains intact but with damaged axons and their endoneurium. And a grade 4 injury in which there is an intact epineurium but with damaged axons, endoneurium and perineurium. Grade 2 injury has the potential for full recovery within several months. In comparison, grade 3 injury recovery is much slower and incomplete, whereas for grade 4 injury, spontaneous recovery is highly unlikely and requires surgical intervention.
Third, we have neurotmesis, in which there is complete transection of the nerve. This type of injury is the most severe and is classified as a grade 5 injury. For these injuries, spontaneous recovery is unlikely without surgical repair, and even then, the outcomes are highly variable.
Now, we want to start by discussing the different nerve injuries that result from neuraxial intervention in obstetric patients. There are several different mechanisms through which nerve injury can occur, and these include traumatic, where direct trauma to the nerve via direct needle or injection trauma occurs. Chemical. Chemical exposure results in irritation of the nerve and this causes inflammation. Ischemic, direct compression of a nerve results in the disruption of the nerve's blood supply. And infective, an abscess causes direct compression of a nerve and results in disruption of the nerve's blood supply, so similar to ischemic.
Starting with trauma, the most common issue that can arise is neuritis or neuronal inflammation, in which there is direct nerve trauma from a TUI or spinal needle or injection of solution within the nerve fibre itself, and this disrupts the fibres within a single nerve. Direct trauma can occur with varying severity, as we've discussed earlier. It can affect specific nerves exiting the spine, the spinal cord, or the conus medullaris. And it's worth noting that the conus medullaris can extend below L1, L2 in about 10% of individuals and can be as low as L2 or L3.
Chemical irritation of a nerve results in a clinical syndrome that can lead to permanent loss of neurological function. Adhesive arachnoiditis arises from an irritant, which causes inflammation and subsequent collagen formation between the nerve roots and the pia arachnoid, or the thin membrane that lies just deep to the dura. This adhesion results in progressive atrophy of the nerves as a result of an interruption to their blood supply. Irritants that have been implicated include contrast media, epidural steroids, blood, detergents, and epidural catheters.
There is overlap in the mechanism of nerve damage with infective and ischemic damage, as both result in a direct interruption of the blood supply of the nerve via direct compression. Ischemia can also result from hypotension and a failure to perfuse the nerves.
So we've touched on the types of nerve injury and the mechanisms that result in this. Let's now look at the clinical syndromes where we see nerve damage as a direct result of neuraxial blocks. Now bear with us, there are quite a few to discuss. Starting with direct nerve injury, this occurs, as we've said before, either via direct damage from a needle or via injection of a substance within the nerve itself. This can be prevented by withdrawing the needle if the patient complains of paresthesia during insertion and subsequent redirection of the needle prior to injection of local anesthetic. Signs and symptoms of this type of injury include paresthesia, loss of sensation, and or motor weakness within the distribution of the specific nerve. For us, this means knowing which nerve roots contribute fibers to which nerves, as well as an understanding of sensory dermatomes.
Spinal cord trauma occurs as a result of direct trauma when performing a spinal anesthetic, epidural, or CSE. Patients often experience pain on needle insertion, and this should prompt immediate needle withdrawal. Spinal cord or conus medullaris injury can result in highly variable clinical pictures, which can include the following symptoms: prolonged motor and sensory weakness at and below the level of the injury, symptoms which can be either bilateral or unilateral, and may involve urinary or bowel symptoms. Prevention of this type of nerve injury really relies on two principles: immediate withdrawal of the needle if the patient experiences pain or paresthesia on needle insertion, and avoiding placement of a spinal or epidural above the L3-4 interspace. We know that surface anatomy is highly variable and that subsequently it is difficult to accurately predict the level at where a neuraxial block has been performed. So scanning the patient's back can assist in identifying the correct interspace.
Next, we have cauda equina syndrome, in which there is damage to the cauda equina nerve fibers either by direct trauma or compression. Again, the clinical picture can be highly variable and includes backache, nerve root pain, saddle anesthesia, paraplegia, and urinary and bowel dysfunction. Regarding its prevention, there are several steps the anaesthetist can take. First is avoiding hyperbaric lignocaine, as there have been links between its use and the cauda equina syndrome. Second, strict asepsis on epidural insertion to reduce the risk of epidural abscess formation. And third, be cautious about inserting epidurals in patients with coagulopathies, bleeding disorders, and in whom anticoagulants are being used.
An epidural hematoma can occur spontaneously in patients who have not had a neuraxial block or in patients that have received a neuraxial block and that also have a coagulopathy, bleeding disorder, or in whom the neuraxial block was difficult to insert. The hematoma occurs mainly in the epidural space because of its prominent venous plexus. Epidural hematoma causes neural ischemia as a result of direct compression, and clinical signs include rapid onset acute back pain, nerve root irritation and pain, and lower limb motor weakness. Paralysis is a late sign.
Prevention of epidural hematoma development includes choosing the appropriate timing for block placement or catheter removal in individuals on anticoagulant medication and potentially excluding coagulopathic patients from neuraxial anesthesia. Interestingly, 50% of epidural hematomas are reported to occur at the time of catheter removal. Of importance to us as anaesthetists, this complication is thankfully very rare. No vertebral canal hematomas were reported in the NAP3, where over 300,000 obstetric patients were included. And according to the British Journal of Anaesthesia Education article titled Postnatal Neurological Problems, the incidence is believed to be between 0.2 and 3.7 per 100,000 blocks. Consensus on safe coagulation parameters for neuraxial insertion do not exist, and ultimately, the decision on when to insert or refuse neuraxial anesthesia lies with the individual. Now, I'm curious, Kate, what's your practice?
So I try to use some of the guidelines that are out there that exist. You know, so there's ESRA guidelines and there's American guidelines as well about coagulation and regional and neuraxial anesthesia. So I think they're a bit of a guide. I think particularly with neuraxials in the obstetric population, it's a pretty uncommon problem because most of them aren't on anticoagulants.
Yeah.
I think when in doubt, probably not, you know. Yeah. So generally the rough sort of guide in my institution would be platelets of around about 80 for an epidural.
Oh, okay.
And around about,
my personal practice is it's a little bit higher. So I normally, my cutoffs previously have been a platelet count of 100 for epidurals, and I actually don't really have, I've always erred on the side of caution, and I haven't done spinal anesthesia for patients with a platelet count of less than 100, but I do know of colleagues who will go down to 80, 70, even 50, which makes me a bit uncomfortable. But again, it's highly individual, and I think, you know, as you've mentioned, there are guidelines. They can be variable in their recommendations. So I think you just, in many instances, we just pick one and stick with it. As long as you can justify your decision-making, that seems to be.
Yeah, no, look, I agree with that. I think, epidurals, you know, around about 90, 100, spinal, 70, 80, just depending on the individual practitioner. Aspirin is fine. And then pretty much anything that's, inverted commas, stronger than aspirin, you know, we tend not to.
It's a no-no, yeah.
It's a little bit, look, I think it can be a little bit different in your fraction ecphema population or a more frail population where you've got someone with terrible respiratory comorbidities, won't go into that. But,
And I think certainly with current guidelines for the NOF patients, the tendency is more towards doing a neuraxial even with questionable reversal of anticoagulation or borderline INR or platelet function or factor 10A. Activity. But certainly in the obstetric population, I think we definitely err on the side of caution, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, we have alternatives if needed.
Yes, we do.
They might not be as good, but we'll get there in the end.
We will get there in the end.
So look, following naturally on from hematoma, we have epidural abscesses where patients are deemed at elevated risk if they have any of the following characteristics: prolonged catheter insertion, presence of sepsis, or an inadequate aseptic technique. That's more of a practitioner one than a patient one, isn't it?
Yes.
But anyway,
yes.
Clinical symptoms and signs are similar to that of epidural hematoma, but with added signs of infection, which include fever and raised inflammatory and infective markers. Of note, though, symptoms often present 4 to 10 days postpartum. The most common causative organism is Staphylococcus aureus. Advice for prevention of abscess formation includes strict asepsis as well as caution in placing an epidural in patients who have an infection, particularly those who are pyrexial. Sometimes this can be a challenge for the obstetric anaesthetist, as the process of labour can commonly result in an elevated white cell count. Similar to epidural hematoma, the incidence of epidural abscess is extremely low, with estimated rates identical to that of hematomas at about 0.2 to 3.7 per 100,000 blocks.
Another potential infective complication of neuraxial anaesthesia is meningitis, which is also thankfully rare, but with highly variable incidences reported from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 150,000 blocks. This complication occurs in procedures in which there is a dural puncture, so primarily in spinal anaesthesia or combined spinal epidural. Clinically, patients present with headache, fever, backache and nausea and neck stiffness, and these symptoms usually develop between 1 and 3 days of the dural puncture. It's worth noting that this presentation is very similar to post-dural puncture headache. The most common causative organism is Streptococcus viridans. Prevention relies heavily on strict asepsis, including the use of a face mask.
Arachnoiditis occurs when the arachnoid meningeal layer and subarachnoid space develop inflammation. There have been associations made between the development of arachnoiditis and needle contamination with chlorhexidine. As with many of these complications, the clinical presentation is highly variable and can include the following: progressive symptoms of paresthesia, numbness or leg weakness, but the most commonly reported symptom is pain. Practice to reduce the risk of arachnoiditis includes the use of preservative-free medications in neuraxial anesthesia, the use of low concentration, as in 0.5% chlorhexidine as skin prep, as well as ensuring it is kept on a separate surface away from the epidural or spinal needle, as well as allowing the preparation to dry on the skin before the neuraxial block is performed.
Yeah, they're simple things, but it's interesting watching trainees do blocks. You see a lot of variation in practice and, you know, something to keep in mind is that, you know, cutting corners here and there and trying to be fast can actually have big implications for the patient. So it's something that's worth keeping in mind.
Yeah, I'm quite obsessional about keeping. I mean, yeah. You know, there's the poor, there's a case report, I think her name was Grace, by a lady from Sydney that ended up as a paraplegic from arachnoiditis from accidental injection of chlorhexidine. And, you know, you read that paper once and you keep your chlorhexidine very separate from anything you're going to inject.
Absolutely. So. I'm the first to admit that I'm actually obsessive, bordering on a bit weird about the way that chlorhexidine is handled when it comes to any sort of procedure. Preemptive apologies for anyone working with me. Okay, so now we're on the home stretch with vascular injury. Now, as discussed, when talking about epidural hematomas, injury to vessels of the epidural venous plexus can occur as a direct result of needle trauma. Another potential but rare complication, with an incidence of about 1 in 500,000 blocks, is the anterior spinal artery syndrome, in which there is a failure of the blood supply to the anterior spinal cord via the artery of Adamkiewicz. And I hope I pronounce that properly. The most likely mechanism for this failure of perfusion specific to neuraxial anesthesia is through prolonged hypotension. But it's worthwhile remembering that other mechanisms, not necessarily in the obstetric population, resulting in the development of this clinical syndrome include trauma, atherosclerosis, aortopathies, vasculitis, and emboli. It can present with paraplegia below the level of the lesion due to interruption of the corticospinal tracts, but proprioception and vibration are preserved as there is no compromise to the dorsal column neurons. Autonomic dysfunction can present as hypotension, bladder or bowel dysfunction, and areflexia.
And coming in as the lucky last is the potential complication of a cranial nerve palsy, which has an incidence of about 1 in 100,000. This complication occurs as a result of CSF leakage, which results in a change in the intracranial pressure, which then causes mechanical damage to cranial nerves, the most commonly affected being the abducens nerve or cranial nerve 6. Spontaneous resolution of this clinical condition occurs in 60% of people within 1 week.
Now, we have lots more to discuss and very little time, so be sure to join us for part 2, where we'll take a close look at intrinsic obstetric palsies and discuss our approach to the obstetric patient with postnatal neurological symptoms.
Well, it's been a great discussion and a timely refresher on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Consultants and fellows, don't forget to claim CPD for listening. Instructions for how to do this are in our episode notes.
If you have any episode suggestions or you'd like to say hi, you can email us at deepbreathspod@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.